And this is KPCW. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Let's see, taking a look at the weather right now. We've got 63 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and they're mostly sunny skies, 55 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday. It's time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Monday, we've got lots of sunshine with just a couple of high clouds expected and temperatures on the very hot side. Highs will be climbing in the upper 80s, closing in on 90 degrees in Park City as we go throughout your Monday afternoon. The Heber Valley, well, yes, we're going to be in the mid to upper 90s for our high temperatures this afternoon. So it is going to be kind of a scorcher out there across the area. Now, as we go into your Tuesday, we're going to see more of the same, more hot conditions. We'll kick off the day with temperatures in the mid-50s in the Heber Valley, temperatures right around 60 in Park City. But as we go throughout your Tuesday, look for mostly sunny to partly sunny skies in the afternoon, but it's still going to be hot. High temperatures right around 90 for Park City. Highs will be climbing into the mid-90s there in the Heber Valley. We will add in a slight chance of a few isolated storms for Tuesday afternoon as a weak frontal boundary kind of works its way across the area. Don't expect a ton of rainfall, but there is a chance of a few isolated rumbles as that system moves on through. As we go into your Wednesday, we're looking at lots of sunshine. Again, we'll call it partly sunny skies in the afternoon. Still a slight chance of an isolated pop-up shower for your Wednesday afternoon as well. Temperatures will be slightly cooler with highs only in the mid-80s for Park City and highs in the low 90s here as we get towards the Heber Valley. But don't get used to that cool down, because as we go into the rest of the week, we start to warm it right back up. Temperatures high in the mid to upper 80s in Park City as we get towards your Thursday and Friday. Highs will be into the low 90s for us in the Heber Valley, and we'll see those low 90s turn into low to mid 90s as we get towards the upcoming weekend with lots of sunshine as high pressure remains large and in charge of the forecast across the area. Park City will see those highs climbing into the mid to upper 80s as we get towards the weekend as well. So we've got us a hot weekend store for us, with the hottest day, of course, coming up for us today and tomorrow afternoons. And again, we'll hopefully get a chance of an isolated storm by your Tuesday afternoon. Let's look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 forecast meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, coming up on the local news hour this morning, stay tuned. I'll be checking in with Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Later on, Executive Director of Swanna Preserve and Nature Center, Lewis Cogan, with details of the community survey, as well as some upcoming events. And from Leadership Park City, Executive Director Scott Von Hartisfeld with some details on applying for Leadership Class 32, as well as a reminder about tonight's Leadership Alumni Picnic. We're taking a look at some local news. As Wasatch County evolves with new arrivals and shifting demographics, county leaders say the general plan is a way to share early settlers' values. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has details.
Wasatch County is in the midst of its first general plan update since 2001. The plan is a guiding document that includes information about land use, development plans, economic growth, and more. More than two decades after the document's last version, the county has seen some major changes. Its population has more than doubled, and it's projected to double again by 2060, according to a staff report. At a Wasatch County Planning Commission meeting Thursday, county staff shared a draft of the introduction to the new general plan and asked for feedback. County Management Analyst Richard Breitenbecker said the general plan should tell the story of the community's past. He highlighted the stories of early settlers from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who he says were driven by faith and determination and shaped by the landscape itself.
They believed in providence. They believed in each other. They believed in living good lives. The values they lived together with this land laid a foundational character for our communities that has been transmitted through generations.
Breitenbecker said longtime county residents care about preserving those pioneer values, even as the community rapidly transforms. He asked the planning commissioners to share their vision for the future of Wasatch County.
Those two questions were ideally to get you out of the normal hat you wear and to become, for a moment, a cowboy poet, to be someone who can speak the values of the community. What would you say?
Some planning commissioners said they'd like to see the general plan be a guiding document for the whole county's values. The general plan only applies to the unincorporated county, not cities or towns. But in surveys and community outreach, Assistant Planning Director Austin Corey said residents often talk about Heber City and Wasatch County as synonymous.
Some of that is because of the history. The Heber Valley is what Wasatch County was 30, 40 years ago. Right. That's all the population was. And so we're trying to break that cycle and recognize that the county has changed.
Planning Commissioner Daniel Lyman said he thought it would be uphill work to help residents understand that the general plan won't have any bearing on Heber City's land use decisions.
I'm still struck by this fact that Heber City has just been a malignant cancer lately, stealing all this land. Honestly, I think this is fantastic for our purposes, but I don't think the general population in this valley understands that it doesn't affect them directly because we're only unincorporated county.
Corey said educating people about what's included in the county is part of the general plan process. He estimated around 17,000 people live in Heber, 18,000 live in the unincorporated county, and about 5,000 total live in smaller municipalities, including Midway, Hideout, and Wallsburg. Planning commissioners alluded to some locals' resistance to rapid growth in the valley. Corey said planning staff have tried to take a glass-half-full approach in response to those concerns.
Stupid Californians.
In some ways, that's why the theme, if you've noticed, the theme of the general plan that we've selected is cultivating communities.
About 500 people filled out a survey this spring to help guide the general plan update. Corey said residents most commonly shares that the community is the most important thing about the county.
Everything we're doing is to try to bring people together to improve connections and relationships with one another.
The planning department will share a new draft with the commission at a future meeting, although no date has been set yet. The county council will also give feedback on what's been written so far at its meeting Wednesday. To read the draft, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Director Phil Bonnerant. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with an update on measles. Have any cases been reported here in Summit County? I mean, we've got some just in Utah County, yeah?
Yeah, Utah County and then down in the southwest region of the state, St. George area. But right now, we're still free of any measles cases in Summit County. We've shifted our focus from the national attention to the local attention, being that we now have it in the state of Utah. So you most likely have read the story over the weekend that it was detected in wastewater in Provo, in an area where the cases in Utah County did not live, or it wasn't in the capture zone of that wastewater system, which indicates that it might be a little bit wider spread than originally anticipated. And so we're on full alert here in Summit County. The team is doing what we can to get messaging out, to work with our schools. You know, the timing of this is really tough. We're about a month out from school starting, a little bit more, and we start to see these cases pop up. So in an effort to be on our best game and to make sure that our community partners are aware of what's taking place, I've been in touch with Mike Lewers over at Snyderville Basin and the Water Rec Department to make sure that we're all set there to begin measles testing in our wastewater as well. We're having conversations with the superintendents of the school districts and their nursing staff about what we can expect come the first of the year, and just really be as ready as we can, knowing all that we know about measles, implementing the state disease plan, and then helping families know that, yeah, measles is not likely going to cause significant illness in families if you're unvaccinated, but there is a high likelihood that it's gonna disrupt your life for a short period of time. And when we think about what this looks like in our schools, if you are a family that is unvaccinated or have an exemption from vaccinations, your child might be sick for a few days, but most likely they're going to miss out on some key things in school, whether that's a sporting event, a dance, or some other school event. If someone is positive for measles inside of the school setting, and the child is the children that have been exposed are unvaccinated, they will have to be excluded from those events. And we don't want any child to miss out on really interesting, exciting, fun events. And so just trying to get information out ahead of time and helping families understand the responsibility that they have in the event that we have a measles case in the school.
Okay, so we haven't been testing our local wastewater for measles at this point, huh?
No, not up to this point. We've been working closely with our partners at the State Department of Health and Human Services to get this up and going. Because the funding is limited for a program like this, we wanted to wait until the first identified case was found in the state. Now that we're at that point, and we've seen cases across different jurisdictions that are unconnected or unrelated, Now is the perfect time to implement that type of surveillance.
Yeah, and again, remind us, I mean, measles is highly, highly contagious.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's the benchmark for many of the diseases that we keep track of, and it's considered the most contagious preventable disease known to public health. And so we ask that people keep that in mind as you're out and about, and keep a close idea or a close eye on those symptoms that are related to measles and all things measles.
Okay. It sounds like you got some good news with regard to the budget. So what does the federal budget mean for Summit County?
Yeah, the federal budget with currently right now, it's a really complex timeline for us in public health because we have three different budget timelines that we work with. We have the federal budget that starts October 1. We have a state budget that starts July 1, and then we have a county budget that starts January 1. And because we depend so much on those federal grants that are administered through the state and then a partial funding of the state grants that are given to the legislature, we have to kind of navigate these three different landmark dates to try and build a budget around. We did learn that the big, beautiful bill was passed, and there's still some conversations that need to take place around funding allocations, with the expectation that by October 1st of this year, we'll know what our funding looks like from the federal level for July 1st of 2026. So we have about a 9-month runway up to that point.
Yeah, so go ahead.
And so what we know now is that the funding for fiscal year 26, which started July 1st, we've received about 90% of that funding. We do have a shortfall in our public health emergency preparedness programming and our immunizations programming. Given the importance of that, or both of those programs, especially immunizations at a time when that doesn't appear to be a priority for our current administration, we have committed to prioritizing any funding shortfalls we have in that program. And use reserve funds to make up the difference there. We don't ever want a family that wants to be immunized to not have that opportunity because of decisions outside of our control. So at the health department, in collaboration with our chief financial officer at the county administration and the council and the Board of Health, we've set aside reserve funds for any type of emergency. And in my opinion, immunizations is at the top of that list of not necessarily an emergency, but making sure that those resources continue to be available in this community.
All right. We have reported that no full-time year-round employees would be let go, but contracted staff will be. What are we talking about?
Yeah, we've been very fortunate that all of our full-time staff at the health department, we have been able to retain those individuals, and I suspect that will be the case moving forward for the foreseeable future. In an effort to do that, we did have to part ways with some of our contract employees that provided valuable services to this community and to the department. But those contracts were time limited and did have a termination date on them. Unfortunately, we did have to bump that termination date or end the contract a little bit early in some cases. And then in others, we had termination dates of June 30th that we weren't able to renew those date or those contracts for those individuals due to funding being cut or us deciding to reserve funding for other programming where we had full-time staff.
Yeah, so how many people are we talking about?
So far, we have had to part ways with three contract employees. We have had two employees that have left under their own circumstances that we have held off on hiring, but I am happy to report that with the information we've received from the state about our funding moving forward, we are able to hire a new or backfill a spot in our early intervention program for a speech therapist and then backfill one of our immunization nursing positions that has been vacated.
Okay, so those two contracted positions, so a total of three is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Five, and then, but you're adding the other two.
Yes, correct.
Okay, so did you have to buy out the contracts for the other that were early terminations?
No, in public health funding, contracts of that nature typically have a clause in there that if the funding goes away, unfortunately, we're unable to keep the contract going. And, that's responsible public health, but it's also being a responsible steward of public health money. And so while we love and appreciate the work that those individuals have done, we do have an obligation to make sure that we're being responsible with the general fund monies that we receive and the grant monies we receive to take a finite resource and allocate it in a way that's most beneficial for this community.
Yeah, so what were those contracts for?
One was for our Medical Reserve Corps coordinator. And you may remember the name or the title Medical Reserve Corps as the group that really organized our COVID-19 vaccination response over at the film studio. We did have a contract nurse that was helping still promote safe COVID-19 practices and immunizations. We let that individual go. And then the last was what we actually had two nurses. The other was a what we call a home visitation nurse that was offering vaccinations and services inside of the home for individuals that were homebound or unable to get into the health department for services.
Okay. Let's see. Coming up Wednesday, the 16th, a free soil and also a low-cost blood lead testing event. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is an exciting event that we have had a great opportunity to partner with the Park City Farmers Market. And on Wednesday the 16th from 11 to 5, we're offering lead screening in partnership with the Utah Department of Health. And so what this looks like is there's two different services being offered. The first is lead testing in soil. And a family individual can show up with a gallon-sized bag of soil from their garden, from their play area in their house, anywhere around their place of residence that they would like tested. And the State Department of Health is bringing up an XRF radar gun that can determine the amount of lead in that sample of soil. And they can do that on site. The readout is immediate, and that whatever is brought in will have a better understanding of what the lead content in that soil might be. The second is a blood lead test that's being offered by our clinical division, where there's a brief finger prick. We take a sample of blood, and then through a newly acquired analyzer, we're able to look at the blood and see how much lead is actually in the blood. And then based on those results, provide information to that individual on hopefully there's no lead in their blood, which would be great, but if there is, some resources on how they can remediate that.
Okay, so that's not done in a routine blood test, huh? A lead measure?
No, generally that has to be ordered by a primary care physician if there was, if it was suspected that there had been a lead exposure. This is a service we offer around the clock at the health department and have families that come in. We've also had individuals that have attended their primary care physician for not feeling well. At that time, we've been notified of elevated blood lead levels where our team will go in and do an investigation of the home to see if that exposure occurred inside the home.
Yeah. Are you talking still paint? Is that even a thing anymore?
It's not as common as it once was, but there's a number of different things where individuals can be exposed to lead. Sometimes, as odd as it may seem, in children, we've seen exposures come through car keys where a parent will, a child is fussing or needs something to capture their attention, and you hand them your set of car keys, and then the car keys go into their mouth or whatever it might be. And lead is used as one of the elements inside of making keys, whether it's a house key or a car key. And so if that's in their mouth, we see some exposure there. And it's not if you're exposed to lead, it is, you can remediate it. There are certain things you can do to limit that exposure moving forward, but also get rid of the lead in your system. And so that's really what this is about, is if we have an exposure or somebody has an elevated level, helping educate and provide resources on how to keep that from happening again.
Yeah, so like, what do you do? I mean, is it just something you eat, or are you actually taking some kind of prescription medicine to remove lead?
Yeah, it can be both, depending on the severity. If we had a situation where we did a initial test and found that the level was extremely elevated, we would take action to have that individual seek additional care where they could be given a prescription. And then there's other things like drinking milk and those types of things where the body will naturally process lead, but there are certain foods and drinks that can help expedite that process inside the body.
Cilantro, I've heard.
Okay, I'll have to do some research on that, but that's a tasty choice if you're trying to get rid of lead.
Okay, and then if somebody's bag of dirt should show some kind of positive lead in it, what happens? I mean, is that remediated?
That's where we would want the individual to contact, their individual whether it's a homeowners association, their city, the county, just depending on what it looks like. We anticipate naturally occurring lead in the soil. But this gives individuals an opportunity that maybe if they've got a garden where they've planted a lot of vegetables, understanding what the soil makeup is there of the garden is extremely valuable for families. And so maybe it comes down to removing that soil and starting fresh again next year and being very careful and wary of the vegetables you eat this year.
Okay. The county has issued a request for qualifications for behavioral health services. What's the purpose of this? I was thinking, didn't we just approve the University of Utah contract?
Yeah. Yeah,
7 months ago?
Yeah, so the RFQ is a request for quotation around our respite care for families that are dealing with a mental health situation in youth. One of the requirements that the council has adopted as the mental health authority is to provide respite care for those families. We all know it's extremely difficult to go through any type of situation like that, especially for the individual experiencing that mental health situation. But it's also very difficult for the families, the mom, dad, caretaker, guardian, whoever that might be. And as we've looked at this and tried to go down this path with an RFP, request for proposal in the past, it's proven difficult to find a provider to provide respite care, not only because it takes a special person to be able to do that, but the qualifications are rather extensive, and the cost to do business up here for a service that isn't needed on a daily basis, it just doesn't pencil out. So we've moved the process to a request for quotation or a quote so that we can do single case agreements, meaning that if we have a family that's experiencing a mental health situation and the caretakers, the parents need a brief respite from that service or that care, we have a way to do that. Now, our partners at Jewish Family Services offer this for adults, but have not been able to, we haven't been able to find services for youth. And it does take, like I said, a different credentialing and a different approach to respite care for youth. So in an effort to be innovative, creative, we have approached it this way. Our behavioral health director, Aaron Newman, continues to find ways to provide services for the community around mental health, and this is just another approach to that.
Okay, Phil, I'm out of time. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, appreciate your time this morning.
Okay, thank you. That's Phil Bondurant again, Summit County Health Department Director. The Swanner Preserve and Eco Center is embarking on a 2025 strategic planning process. In the studio with details, I have the Executive Director, Lewis Gogan. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much.
Great.
So tell us what are you doing?
Absolutely. Well, let me first just real quick, since I'm not sure all listeners are familiar with Swanner, the Swanner Preserve and Eco Center is a 1,200-acre nature preserve in Kimball Junction. So it's on both sides of Interstate 80 when folks are driving by there, they probably notice this huge open space down there, you know, to the south of the highway, and then that big open hillside below Glenwild. That's the Swanner Preserve. If it wasn't there, you know, the entrance to Park City would look very different. And we have a beautiful LEED Platinum Eco Center, Nature Center facility there. It was the first center in Utah to be constructed at that level of sustainable construction. We're extremely proud of it. We do all kinds of programming. Our mission, our three-part mission, is to protect and nurture lands, water, and the living things under our care. We provide a lot of opportunities for people to deepen their understanding of how the natural systems around us function, the role that we play, why it's important. And then finally, we work to strengthen the connection that people feel with the earth and also with each other. And now to answer your question, yeah, the last time that Swanner had a strategic plan was in 2003. So it's been 22 years since we had a strategic plan. A lot has changed. We didn't have a nature center at that time. We weren't a part of Utah State University Extension at that time. We didn't even have a funded executive director position. So a lot has changed. And I think that we are now in a pivotal moment where the organization can say, hey, we accomplished everything that the organization had set out to do back in the early 2000s, and we're ready now to pivot, to look to the future and think about who do we want to be and how are we going to serve this community and also our community members' children and their children. It's a, you know, we're working on a 5-year strategic plan, but given how we're set up, I think we're also, what we're doing is laying the groundwork for the more distant future and who we want to be for the community.
Okay, so in order to put together a strategic plan, you're asking the community and to think, to tell you what they think?
Absolutely. I think there's kind of a couple of things we really fundamentally want to understand from the community right now. One of those, a crucial element, is to help us better define the nuances of our mission to preserve, to educate, and to nurture. We want to help the community, help us understand what environmental preservation actions are the most important, which is SWANR best positioned to advance. We want the community to help us know how can we best meet their desire to educate themselves, their children, their community members about the environment and how we can care for the earth. And also, really importantly, how can we best foster a community of diverse people coming together around a shared love and respect for our place on this planet. And one of the other things that I think we really want to hear from individual community members, from listeners on the show right now, is we want to hear people's own SWANR story. You know, like, how do they engage with SWANR if they do? And what does it mean to them? What is the value? And even for those in the community who perhaps don't engage with SWANR or haven't yet, it impacts everyone in this community, whether it's the wildlife that is present, it's the view shed for the community, it's the water in our community, it's the land, and it's the ability of this community to make sure that part of our identity is still the connection that we and our children feel to the landscape. And so we want to hear from people, like, what that means to them. We have a survey that just went live. It's on our website at swannerecocenter.org. So if people go to swannerecocenter.org, it's the first clickable item, the first tab. And it takes about 15 minutes if you really are answering all the open-ended questions. But if people only have 5 minutes, please still, we ask that you go on there. You can skip the open-ended questions and just help us understand what your key priorities are. And that'll really help inform our process.
Yeah, what are some of the Preserve and Eco Center's priorities?
Well, I would say that they remain really focused on making sure that the preserve, which is, you know, the land, the water, and the wildlife that is under our care there at SWANR, is as healthy as it possibly can be, and that we are really completing that circle of, like, people helping nature so that nature can help people, and building community in that space, I think, is incredibly important. And then just making sure that all of the members of this community feel included in this community of, you know, ecophiles, of people who understand and benefit from the value of the natural world.
Yeah. My guess is that after 20 plus years, your eco center is probably feeling a little bit small. Are there plans to try and expand?
That's something that this strategic plan can really help inform for us. You know, I think helping us understand exactly what does this community value most. And in terms of our programming, it'll be, you know, I think one of the outcomes here will help us understand how badly do we need additional space.
Yeah. And what's the timeline on this?
We started last fall with a lot of deep dive work with our advisory board and our staff. We pivoted that into a series of community focus groups that we completed this spring, along with a bunch of Spanish language interviews with Spanish speaking community members to make sure that perspective is not left out. And this survey is gonna be open into early August, but I would still encourage people to go on there and take our survey as soon as possible. The sooner we get feedback, the easier it is for us to do a good job completing our process. But then, you know, come fall, we'll work to really be assimilating all of the responses that we get from people, and we'll have a deep dive retreat with our board and staff and work to kind of put this all together into that strategic document.
Okay, so you expect to have that strategic plan by the end of the year?
I would say the end of the year, early next year, yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else you want to tell us about the survey itself?
I don't think there's anything else to say about the survey itself, but I'd love to, if we have a little more time, I'd love to talk a little bit about some upcoming opportunities for people to get engaged there at Swanner.
Go ahead.
There is so much happening in the next 3 to 4 weeks. Really exciting stuff. So we have our annual Wine Among the Willows event coming up on Saturday, August 2nd from 3 to 6. This is a really cool opportunity. If you like wine, if you're interested in wine, this is something we try to do every year where you can come actually sit out on the preserve and sample a bunch of different wines that are either sustainably produced, biodynamic, or just innovative, and have folks from our partner Vine Lore talk all about those wines and the process of producing them. It's just a really good time and a wonderful, unique way to enjoy being out on the preserve. On July 22nd, we have our Bike and Botany event, which is a collaboration with Basin Recreation, and also we'll have some subject matter experts from USU Extension joining. You get out on bikes, learn all about the native flora here in Swanner, or around Swanner and Snyderville Basin. On August 14th, we've got a history hike collaboration with the Park City Museum and Utah Open Lands. I want to point out we still have a few summer camp spots open. If you've got a first through fourth grader, our summer camps are running through mid-August. We still have a couple spots open there. And for middle schoolers, applications for Eco Club for the coming year are also open right now. This is a really, really cool environmental education and eco service club for 6th to 8th graders. They have such a good time. It's a great community building exercise. I can't speak highly enough of Eco Club. So if you have a rising 6th through 8th grader who might be interested, please check that out. And then just finally, there's so many service activities happening all the time. There's nothing like building community by getting your hands dirty out on the preserve. It's such a great way to participate.
Okay. Back to the Bike and Botany happening. People need to have their own bike?
They can rent their, they can get their own bike. If they need a bike and don't have their own, just let us know before the event and we can make sure to help facilitate that.
Okay, and there's a fee to that?
Bike and Botany is, that's a great question. I don't think there's a fee. I know there is a fee for Wine Among the Willows. So
sure.
All the info is on the website.
Okay. All right, anything else?
Yeah, I'm just curious, if I may be so bold. Leslie, you've been around for quite some time. Do you remember the first time that you heard about Swanner?
Yeah, when it was gonna happen. I remember, Leland as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just curious, like, if you think about your very first experience with Swanner, what was that? Do you remember the balloon festival out there, or what was the first time you really
remember
getting involved?
No, I remember the balloon festival in Park Meadows.
Yeah.
So that was even before Swanner, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot has changed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You're grateful for it, right?
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Okay, Lewis, anything else?
No, that's all. Thanks so much, Leslie. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, Lewis Kogan is the executive director of the Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Leadership Park City, as we've reported, is accepting applications for Class 32. In the studio with details, I have the director of the program, Scott Van Hartesveld. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. It's good to see you.
Yeah, so let's start first. I mean, how did year one go as your first year of director?
It's been wonderful. It really has. I was so blessed to have the class that I did. I think I got lucky. I love every single one of them. They have bonded as a class. Our programming and the community who have stepped up to help with that programming has gone really, really well. And we got through City Tour.
Without losing anybody.
Without losing anybody that we know of.
Okay. So are you able to manage both the leadership role as well as your business? Because you've got a full-time job, don't you?
It's a good question. I think it depends on the week, but it is, I have a tremendous amount of passion for both. And I think that really helps. I like being busy. I like being involved. My business, GCommerce, has been around for 23 years. We have a tremendous team, and I lean into them and rely on them every single day. So that gives me some freedom to be able to invest on the leadership side and to invest in the community, which has been, like I said, a real gift for me.
Okay. Again, it's that time of year when applications are available. People need to go online.
So somebody before my time did a tremendous job securing the best URL for this in the world. It is so easy. It is applyforleadership.com. Applyforleadership.com. One of the great decisions that was made in the program. We are opening applications through August 22nd. They are open today, and we're doing something a little new this year. I have had a lot of conversations with people in the community during this application process where they have questions that may hold them back from applying for the program. And so we're going to do an open house this year from 5:30 to 7 o'clock on August 4th. It's just going to be at the Park City Library. It's free to attend. I'm going to be there. Paige Galvin, my partner in this, is going to be there. We're going to have a couple of alumni and a couple of members of the existing class that can provide some context and some contours of what the program is and answer some of those nagging questions that might hold somebody back from applying.
All right. So what does it take to get in?
You know, I think first and foremost, it is a belief and investment in the community. We have a wonderful selection committee, and I think that that's the first thing that they look for is people who really care about this place. And that doesn't have to come from a single perspective. One of the great things about this program is we have such diversity of thoughts, opinions, of backgrounds. I think our youngest this year was 17 years old and our oldest was in their mid-60s. We have people from government, nonprofit, the private sector. It's really this wonderful and diverse group, but they all care about our community and they want to contribute to it. You need to live and or work in Summit County. That is the only stated requirement for the program.
Okay. And again, you mentioned it's a selection committee that decides who gets in.
That's correct. Miles Radiman, the founder of this program, who ran it for 30 years, one of the other great decisions, and one of the many great decisions that he made, was that he did not select the class. It is a selection committee made up of alumni of the program, people who have been through it, understand what it takes to be successful, and who remain in the community that help score the applications. And then there's a deliberative process to help finalize the selection of the class.
All right. Some people do get in on their first try. Others don't get in, trying two, maybe even three times. Should they keep trying?
I believe they should. And I think we have some tremendous success stories of people who are very well known in the community who did not get in on their first try or their second try or even their third try and have gone on to make significant contributions to the community. So, yeah, I would encourage people to continue applying. In addition to that, we offer some programming that's open to the public, and we always encourage people who maybe have applied once or twice who haven't yet participated in that programming to come. Leadership Symposium is going to happen in February, which is kind of a civics cornucopia of everything that's going on in the community. That's open to the public and held at the hospital every year.
All right, so when does the new class begin?
New class is going to start on October 3rd. Yes, I got that right. On October 3rd, the graduation ceremony and the welcoming for the new class happens on the same night, which is really wonderful. And then that weekend, we will take them to the new class, to the NAC, for orientation and some ropes coursing.
Okay. So what does somebody get out of participating?
It's a really good question. You know, the first thing that I would say, this quote has been sticking in my mind for a long time. Miles always used to say it. If you know Miles, you know this quote. Find your place in the world, dig in, take responsibility from there. I think the program, our job is to provide the shovels and to help you dig in. And what you do from there is up to you. So the program really provides people with that jumping off point for being further involved in the community, for really understanding some of the nuance of how things work here. The other thing that is that you can't not talk about with this program, every time I meet alumni, it's never the programming they talk about. Oftentimes it's Miles and fun Miles stories, but really it is the community that they build with their class. These are people that you normally wouldn't find yourself interacting with necessarily in your own circles, your own community, but they become lifelong friends. They become people that you see in your community and you have in your life for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about, I mean, there are some other requirements in terms of participation. You do need to make the sessions.
That's exactly correct. Thank you for mentioning that. We do ask people, this is a scholarship-driven program. It is scholarships provided by Park City Municipal and the partners who participate in the program. So as in exchange for that, we ask that people participate and not only show up to the sessions. We publish the schedule in advance. It's part of the, it's on our website so that you can see and make sure that you can make that commitment. So don't just come, but participate and invest and be involved in that, because it's a highly competitive selection process, as you know, Leslie. And so we want people who end up making it through that to be really invested in what they're doing.
Sure. And you mentioned there is a scholarship, yet participants are expected to pay for their, you know, the cost to attend city tour. Yeah,
that's
which
exactly
is
right.
About $800 maybe, huh?
It can be, yeah. It can be between $800 and $1,200. Some of that is depending on what you do outside of the official programming, right? So if you go out at night, then that's up to you.
Okay. Are there scholarships available for people who may not have that?
We have started that. That program has been going on for a little while now, and we're looking to build more into that to make sure that the program is really accessible to people from any part of this community. So, yes, again, thank you for mentioning that. We do have scholarships available for City Tour for those who need it.
All right. And after your first year, any changes that you kind of like, I think this needs to be changed, or are you keeping it pretty much the same?
I think that leadership was built through an iterative process by Miles and the people who helped support him. So there's a lot that's really good about this program. The DNA of the program is exactly, in my opinion, where it needs to be. It needs to continually evolve to reflect the community. So the programming that we did this year, everything from, you just had Phil Bonner on. Phil was part of a panel that we did on public health and safety. That was new. We had never done something like that before, to my knowledge. We just did a panel on women in leadership and arts and culture in the community. These are all reflections, I think, of where the community is today, and that will continue. I think that the programming that we deliver hopefully will be new and exciting and relevant to what's going on in the community at any particular time. And then the second piece that I'll mention is we're really focusing on a leadership training framework and how we want to help provide kind of really core leadership training for people who are maybe emerging as leaders or who have been leaders for a long time to all find value in something that they can continue to hone their own skills with.
All right. Also, I wanted to ask to get you to respond to something we saw briefly online. I think it was Reddit. And it said something. It's since been taken down, so I wasn't able to show you personally. Mm. But it said something along the lines of, I'm sick of paying for leadership. Taxpayers pay for the salary of the director, and they never finish any of the projects they start. Mm. What's your thought about that?
I think the programs and the projects that have been developed have two outcomes to it. The first is the actual project itself. And so I was part of Class 29. Let's Talk, I think, is thriving in this community. That was our class project. That has been taken over by Mountain Mediation, who have done a tremendous job keeping it alive and continuing to provide that civil discourse and civic training that it has done. Summit Land Conservancy. Summit Land Conservancy was a leadership class project and obviously has had a tremendous impact on this community. And so I think you can go back and look at example after example of the projects being really successful. Not all of them are, and that's okay. Part of what we're doing in the process of the class project is teaching people what it takes to work in this community to get things from start to finish. And sometimes we learn as much from failure as we do from success. I think that it is a training ground for activating people to take the lessons that they learn in leadership and learn in a structured way how to apply them as they move forward in the community.
Yeah, someone mentioned, I thought it was the Spanish-speaking app that's had some
Colectiva.
Challenges.
Yeah,
yeah. So it was released and then pulled back, and I don't even know what the status is at this point.
And I have talked to Class 30 on multiple occasions, and I know that it is the idea is alive and well. They continue to work on it, which is really in and of itself remarkable, right? They aren't paid to do this. This is something that is a passion of theirs, and they are continuing to try to bring their vision to life. So, yeah, I'd look for that going forward.
Okay, and then besides your salary, are tax dollars being used?
The entire program cost Miles has always been, Miles was always really consistent that we tried to keep it very, very affordable. I did do a presentation to council. I'm sure that it's available online in terms of what our entire budget is in the breakdown. We have generous support from partners, including Summit County, Vail, Deer Valley. The Chamber is a tremendous supporter of the program as well. And yes, the Park City Municipal also provides provides funding for the program.
Okay. Finally, just wanted to mention, I know it's that time where you've got the alumni picnic happening tonight.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up as well. The alumni picnic, if you are out there and you have, are one of the almost 900 people who have participated in this program, tonight from 5:30 to about 8:30 p.m. at City Park, we have an alumni picnic. Come meet Class 31. They are about to graduate. They're about to become alumni themselves. So meet your fellow alumni and help welcome these new members of Class 31 into the community.
All right. I think you leadership is providing what?
We're doing the mains. Okay. It's being catered. And so we will have the mains, and we're asking people to just bring sides or desserts or things that they want to munch on, as well as their own drinks.
Okay. And again, it's apply to leadership.com.
Apply for leadership.com.
Okay. Scott, anything else?
No, I think that's it. Thank you so much, Leslie.
Thank you. Scott Van Hartesveld, again, the Executive Director of Leadership Park City. Well, the Summit County Clerk's Office will count signatures it rejected in a petition to put Dakota Pacific's development on the ballot. But KPCW's Connor Thomas reports a judge must still decide whether those signatures are valid.
Summit County Clerk Eve Furst will tally the signatures her office rejected earlier this year while a court case over the Dakota Pacific referendum plays out. That way, the referendum can happen in November if Judge Richard Mrozek finds there are enough signatures. Furst reached the agreement July 11th with five petitioners, Angela Mosqueda, Reed Galen, Ruby Diaz, Dana Williams, and Brendan Weinstein, who appealed the signature rejection July 3rd. Here's Mosqueda.
Today's stipulated order is a meaningful step forward for voter rights and for our Summit County community. While Judge Mrozek must still rule on the validity of the rejected packet, we are definitely relieved Clerk Furst has agreed to count signatures in the meantime. This ensures we don't lose critical time in the process and preserves our chance to make the November ballot.
About 4,500 signatures are needed to put the development agreement Summit County Council members approved last December on the November 2025 ballot. The original referendum sponsors say they collected more than 6,000 signatures from residents to put the controversial development to a countywide vote. The clerk's office verified 3,214. Furst previously said in a statement that the clerk's office has followed state statute as interpreted by our attorneys and the lieutenant governor's office. She says her office is ready to follow whatever determination is made. Mrozek has ordered state elections officials to post the previously rejected signatures with a message that reads in part, "These signatures are being provisionally posted pursuant to a stipulated court order pending the resolution of that case." That's because Utah law requires verified signatures to be posted publicly for 45 days before a referendum is placed on the ballot. Furst agreed to tally the signatures in the 30 signature packets provisionally by July 14th. The Utah Lieutenant Governor's office would post them online by July 15th. They won't count toward the total needed to put the referendum on the ballot until the judge makes a ruling.
The right to referendum is fundamental in any functioning democracy. It's how voters hold their government accountable. We are grateful this process can now move forward, and we remain committed to defending that right every step of the way.
Earlier this year, Furst's office received 77 packets and said 30 were invalid after seeing they were three-hole punched, then subsequently spiral bound. The clerk argued photos showed some three-hole punched pages were separated from their packet and said that's not allowed. In their appeal, the petitioners deny any pages in the rejected packets, quote, were separated or circulated apart from those packets. They also argue Furst misinterpreted state law. Both sides have cited Utah Supreme Court cases they say back up their interpretations of the law, but Furst hasn't responded to the appeal in court yet. The development at the center of the controversy is a neighborhood and mixed-use public-private partnership between Summit County and Dakota Pacific Real Estate in Kimball Junction. A primary resident concern has been traffic from the project, which would include just shy of 900 total residences. Separate from the referendum effort, Dakota Pacific has applied for a new but largely similar agreement through the Summit County Planning Department under a 2025 state law written to greenlight the project. County officials believe such an agreement would make a referendum on the December agreement irrelevant. But the new agreement could still be appealed to the county council and then to Third District Court if the county manager approves it. A decision could come during a public hearing tentatively set for July 28th. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.